Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
Summer's here, and Nordstrom has everything you need for your best dress season ever. From beach days and weddings to weekend getaways and your everyday wardrobe, discover stylish options under $100 from tons of your favorite brands like Mango, Skims, Princess Polly, and Madewell. It's easy, too, with free shipping and free returns, in-store order pickup, and more. Shop today in-stores, online at Nordstrom.com, or download the Nordstrom app.
PMS, pregnancy, menopause. Being a woman is a lot. Olly supports you and yours with expert solutions for every age and life stage. They just launched two new products exclusively at Walmart. Period Hero combats bloat, mood swings, and more during PMS. And Balance Perimeno to support hormonal balance, mood, and metabolism during perimenopause. Grab yours at Olly.com.
Olly!
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly. And before we get started, I just want to make a little announcement about some changes that are coming to the show. For those of you who have listened since the beginning and those of you who just started listening recently, I just want to let you all know that after Memorial Day, I am going to be publishing new episodes every 2 weeks instead of weekly. A lot of you already know this, but we are expecting a baby this summer, baby number 4. So we've got some big life adjustments coming our way, also in the form of potentially homeschooling and me just kind of leaning more into my role as a stay-at-home mom. You know, when we started this podcast, we had 2 pretty self-sufficient kids. I'm trying to think of how old they were. I think they were like 6 and 7 at the time, maybe. And now they're about to be 9 and 10. We've got a 2.5-year-old and then a baby on the way. So you guys have been through so much with my family, and I love you so much for that. And I know that a lot of you are going to be so understanding, and I just appreciate that so much. I realize that finding balance has always been really hard for me, and I think that's really hard for a lot of mothers. But the older I get, the more I realize and have accepted that I am only human. I'm only capable of so much. And I just set my expectations for myself way too high sometimes. And I need to be okay with prioritizing certain things over others. I'm sure a lot of you who are listening can relate. So anyway, I hope you all understand and still support us through this change. We have an amazing audience of supportive and caring listeners, so I don't doubt that you'll stick around, but I do just hope you all know how much I appreciate you.
So let's get into today's episode. We are going to be talking about Karen Reed and the ongoing trial. So the last episode we had was discussing part one. We discussed the basics of the story, kind of briefly discussed who's who of the most major players like John O'Keefe, Karen Reed, Jennifer McCabe, and Brian Albert, especially, and Michael Proctor. So if you haven't listened to that one yet, go back and listen before you hop on to part two. Otherwise, you're going to be kind of confused. But in this episode, we're going to be getting into more of the nitty gritty, the theories, the trial, lots of stuff to touch on. I feel like this is going to be probably a multi-part series because the trial is ongoing and it's expected to last like 6 to 8 weeks, which is kind of crazy to think that I could have my baby before we have a verdict in this case, which is just wild. But anyways, let's get into it. So typically the way that I like to dissect and retell a story is to go in chronological order. I think it's just easiest to understand, and I'm going to try to weed out as much of the bullshit that I can, despite this case being so full of shit. I mean, there's so much. If you know, you know. If you don't know, let me do the work for you, because I'm going to try to lay it out as neatly as possible for you. You're welcome, but this story is confusing. So we left off, of course, with the incident where John O'Keefe was found in the front yard of the Alberts' home. And then Karen Reed was arrested and charged with her murder, but a lot of people believe that she is being framed because Brian Albert, the owner of that home where John O'Keefe was found, is a Boston cop, and he's got a lot of familial and friendly ties to law enforcement and elected selectmen from Massachusetts. So we kind of got into that into part one, but now we're going to kind of jump ahead. So on March 12th, Karen Reed's attorney filed for a motion to, one, dismiss the case due to alleged conflicts of interest, and two, also reveal explosive evidence that an expert retained by federal officials reportedly concluded that John O'Keefe's injuries were inconsistent with damage to Karen's car. So in reference to the first motion, Alan Jackson, who's one of the defense attorneys on Karen's defense team, argued to the court that the case should be dismissed due to conflict of interest. Now, in part one, we talked a little bit about Michael Proctor, and, you know, he's the lead detective on the case, and his relationship with the Albert family, Brian Albert being, of course, the one who owned the home where John O'Keefe was found. Obviously, that presents a conflict of interest, but attorney Alan Jackson even alleged that the Canton police sergeant Michael Lank, who arrived on the scene shortly after John was found, also had a personal and lifelong relationship with Brian Albert's brother, Chris. Now, Chris, if you'll remember, is also Colin's dad. Colin Albert is the young kid who was, you know, there was video of him popping off. He's like the hothead. And a lot of people think that maybe he had something to do with the death of John O'Keefe. So Brian is Colin's uncle. Chris is Brian's brother and Colin's dad. Okay. I hope this makes sense, because I know it's hard when you're just listening. At least I'm a visual learner. So I need to have like everything visually laid out. So if I'm confusing you, I'm really sorry. But Alan Jackson even brought up an incident with Sergeant Lank where he used his position as a police officer to protect the Alberts from getting into trouble after there was a bar fight that they were involved in. But that bar fight was actually like 20 years ago, so that might have been a little bit of a reach. Plus, the people involved in that fight weren't even at the house the night that John O'Keefe died. So is it a reach? Maybe, but it certainly lays the foundation that we're dealing with a group of people who all know each other, are fond of each other, work together. They might have reason to protect one another. So back to Michael Proctor, the prosecution keeps trying to deny that he had a relationship with the Albert family, despite so much evidence to the contrary. There are pictures of Michael Proctor mingling with the Alberts. They're attending weddings together. They're even involved in weddings together and the same wedding party. They're at birthday parties together, social events, like you name it. Michael had a relationship with the Alberts. There is just no denying that. And it really makes the prosecution's credibility crumble when they try to deny that despite so much evidence in favor of the defense's argument. They even published a text where Michael Proctor texted Julie Albert, who is Brian's sister-in-law, and Colin Albert's mom asking if she could babysit for him just 10 days prior to John O'Keefe's death. And even more damning, 3 days after John O'Keefe died on the Alberts' property, Michael's sister texted him saying that Julie Albert wanted to give him a thank you gift when all of this is over. Again, Julie Albert is Colin's mom. So ultimately, the motion to dismiss was denied on March 26th, and a lot of people feel like the judge is being really biased in this case. In fact, her name is Beverly Cannon or Cannon, and a lot of people are calling her Bias Beverly, but it does seem like she's just kind of allowing a lot of things to slide, or she's allowing a lot of objections to be sustained, which prevents the witnesses from answering their questions. But anyway, that's kind of more into the nitty-gritty. The trial officially started on April 16th with jury selection. And then on April 28th, the prosecutors and the defense team gave their opening statements. So let's start with the defense's opening statement and the key takeaways from their 45-minute presentation. So the very first line is given by David Yannetti, one of the defense attorneys, and it is, Karen Reed was framed. Her car never hit John O'Keefe. She did not cause his death, and that means that somebody else did, end quote. He then goes on to point out that it's no coincidence that he was found on the front lawn of a well-known and well-connected law enforcement family with close ties to the investigators in this case. He says, you will question their theory, their witnesses, and the quality of their investigation. You'll learn that they didn't do a real investigation, missing a lot of crucial steps, and had tunnel vision on Karen Reed from the get-go. He also points out that Brian Albert knew and was notified that a fellow police officer was found injured and unresponsive on his lawn, and yet he never even bothered to come outside. Despite there being police, EMTs, firefighters, police cruisers, ambulances, lights flashing, and his own sister-in-law outside attending to John O'Keefe, he never came outside to check on the situation. That is bizarre to me, not only because shit's going down in your front yard, but you are law enforcement. Why wouldn't you come out and at least try to help the situation, see if you could be of any help, ask what's going on, like try to get some, I don't know, but it baffles me. And the prosecution's argument in why he didn't go out is because, well, it was a blizzard outside and the neighbors didn't come outside either. I don't give a shit. There's a ton of people outside in your front yard. And you're telling me you're not going to come out and check, even though you work for law enforcement? That's crazy. So anyway, the opening statement for the defense goes on to say that Brian's brother, Kevin, who is a Canton police officer, also should raise a red flag that there could be a conflict of interest and that maybe the Massachusetts State Police should have taken over instead of Canton police. But instead, Kevin was kept heavily in the loop of investigation. And not only that, but Michael Proctor and that whole situation was also a huge conflict of interest, and yet he was chosen to lead the investigation. So obviously, those are huge red flags. Now, despite John O'Keefe being found on the front lawn of the Alberts' home, no officials ever stepped inside the Alberts' home. They never obtained a search warrant. They never secured the area as a potential crime scene, despite pointing the finger immediately at Karen as to being the reason that he died. And they also never collected anything from inside the Alberts' home. Now, this next part is disturbing and also a huge red flag. Michael Proctor was caught texting his buddies in a group chat that was titled High School Buddies, and he was giving them details about the investigation. He told his friends that he hoped Karen Reed would kill herself, and even admitted that he seized her phone and was disappointed because he couldn't find any nudes of her on her camera roll. He didn't have a search warrant or permission from any judge to go through her phone, and yet he did. And then he bragged about it, and then he compromised the investigation by telling his buddies details about it. And then even worse, when one of his friends responded saying something along the lines of, the homeowner catching a lot of grief for having a dead body being found in his front yard, Michael Proctor responded, nope, the homeowner is a Boston cop too. So obviously that indicates that there's going to be some sort of special privilege because he's a Boston cop and they're not going to do this investigation justly. Now, it's revealed during the opening statement that Michael Proctor towed Karen Reed's car from her parents' house, but lied about the time that it was towed, leaving a 90-minute gap of time where the car's handling was unaccounted for, which left ample time for someone to collect evidence from the car, such as, I don't know, pieces of plastic from a cracked taillight, maybe? And what do you know, when four officers thoroughly searched the area where John's body was found for any evidence, nothing was found. But then later in the day, after snow accumulated, after, police then magically found pieces of taillight in the yard. Now, this is a huge deal because we later learned, after pieces of taillight were found, that there was surveillance video of Karen backing into John's SUV around 5 a.m. the morning he was found, after Michael Proctor and police would have needed those taillight pieces to be actually broken. So how did they end up in the yard? Then we learn about Ryan Nagel. Ryan Nagel arrived at the house party that night after Karen and John showed up, and he says he witnessed Karen's SUV with no damage to a taillight, and he testified that he did not see John inside the car, nor did he see John outside, leaving the only other option for him to be inside the house when he got there. So Mr. Iannetti also tells the jury that there was a search made on Jennifer McCabe's phone for how long to die in the cold that was made at 2:27 a.m. This would be hours before John was found, but also hours after Karen left the Alberts' home. But what the prosecution intends to dispute is the time that that search was made, because they are claiming that the search was actually made later that morning while first responders were working on John and the condition and his prognosis was unknown. Now, I'm looking forward to getting into the nitty-gritty of those details to see whose evidence is more plausible. However, the defense has already let us know that they have an expert in the field named Richard Green, who was a leading computer forensic expert in the country, and he forensically analyzed Jennifer McCabe's phone both manually and using computer software to confirm that she did in fact make the search at 2:27 a.m. and then later deleted that search. Why delete it if you made the search after John was found? Why delete it at all? Another interesting choice of omission was made by Brian Albert, who claimed that he had no contact with anyone except for his wife until he was woken up the morning that John's body was found. However, when his phone was analyzed, it was found that he made a call to ATF agent Brian Higgins, his friend who had also been at the house for the party that night. Now, that call was made at 2:22 a.m., which would be 5 minutes before the search, how to die or how long to die in the cold on Jennifer McCabe's phone. So we're all within this like similar time frame here. But Brian Albert made the call to Brian Higgins at 2:22 a.m. and Brian Higgins did not answer. So then Brian Higgins called him back 17 seconds later and they had a 22-second phone call. So just for reference, I'm going to mark right now being the start of 22 seconds, and you'll see how long we can talk for 22 seconds. But the funny thing about these phone calls is that they're all claiming that these phone calls were butt dials. In fact, these butt dials were made in the middle of the night when Brian Albert says he was having sex with his wife. Those are his words. And 3, 2, 1. So that's 22 seconds right there. That's a lot of talking that you can accomplish in a 22-second phone call. Now, this phone call, again, was made 5 minutes before Jennifer McCabe made that search, how long to die in the cold. So what do you think Brian Albert was calling Brian Higgins for? To say, hey, we took care of it. We left him in the front yard and just make sure your story is that he never came into the house. I mean, you can accomplish a lot in a 22-second phone call. Another important point made by the defense is that John's injuries do not align with being hit by a vehicle. No part of his torso was injured. No part of his chest, hips, or legs were injured, despite being hit by a car, a tall SUV at that. So there's damage to the taillight, but not to a human body. Like where the taillight would have hit a human body. And in the last episode, I briefly discussed the scratches that were found on John's right arm. Now, during the trial, an expert forensic pathologist who has conducted thousands of autopsies will testify that the marks are consistent with scratch and claw marks and bite marks from an animal such as a German Shepherd. The Albert family dog was a German Shepherd named Chloe. And curiously, after John's death, the Albert family rehomed Chloe because Nicole, Brian's wife, admitted that she had injured another woman when the dog was in a dog fight. Now, I will say this has already come up during the trial so far, and Terry Kuhn, a forensic scientist from the University of California, Davis, who specializes in animal DNA, testified that she did not find any canine DNA on the two swabs that she received that were allegedly taken from the shirt that John was wearing. However, the defense will try to poke holes in that testimony by pointing out that Terry Kuhn was not present when the swabs were collected and did not know the history of the swabs. She also did not see how they were obtained or how they were packaged. And the problem that this poses for the prosecution is that when the defense's entire argument is based on the Boston police and the state police working together to protect their reputation, to protect their own, and that Karen Reed has been framed, when you have an unbiased scientist come in and do work, you have to consider where her involvement starts. And it's after the police collected those swabs. So then we're left to question the integrity of those swabs because we're questioning the integrity of who collected them, right? So when the prosecuting attorney, Assistant DA Adam Lally, had his turn to deliver their opening statement, it was very calm, dispassionate, to the point, almost boring, honestly. A lot of Adam Lally on the stand has been very boring. But he did reveal that their argument is based on forensic evidence from Karen's SUV that showed Karen reversing 60 feet at a rate of about 22 miles per hour when she hit John, and that then she hit him again while he was down before leaving him to die in the cold. He also intends to argue the multiple witnesses who said that Karen repeatedly said, I hit him," as an admission of guilt. And he also intends to poke holes in the strength of their relationship by highlighting fights that they had leading up to John's death. Now, before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors of today's episode, and that is Book of the Month. Now, I have been diving deep into my reading journey lately, and I'm thrilled to share something that's been a total game changer for me, which is Book of the Month. Book of the Month is more than just a subscription service. They've made it their mission to help readers discover new books they will love and promote the work of emerging authors. Every month, they present a selection of the best new titles, and I recently picked out The Paradise Problem by Christina Lauren and Middle Tide by Sarah Crouch. The Paradise Problem is great if you like contemporary fiction, romance. This particular story has a funny story about fake dating and just a marriage of convenience and complex family dynamics where opposites attract. It reminds me a lot of like a Colleen Hoover type of book. And Middle Tide is great if you really love like the mystery, thriller, true crime with a little romance mixed in. Now, I won't spoil it for you, but the story literally begins with two fishermen who discover a dead body hanging from a tree, and the body is identified as Aaron Landry, who is a prominent doctor. The body is actually found on the property of a former author, and that person becomes the person of interest. And the story is just very twisty and dark. It's very suspenseful. So if you like true crime and mystery thrillers, you will love Middle Tide. Right now, you can head over to bookofthemonth.com and snag your first book for a mere $5 using the code PETALS, P-E-T-A-L-S. It is such a good deal. I cannot recommend Book of the Month enough. And it's not just about receiving books. It's about the joy of discovery. And that's the bookofthemonth.com. Use code PETALS to get your first book for $5. Say Book of the Month.
Book of the Month.
That's my 2-year-old Augie. He's a book lover, too. Now, before we get into what has happened in the trial so far beyond the opening statements, I really want you to think about how wild it is to reverse a vehicle at 22 miles per hour in the snow. I would challenge you, if you ever could in a safe way, to see like how fast you can reverse before it becomes frightening, because you'll be surprised at how low that mile per hour is. I actually get nervous at reversing just like even 10 miles per hour. I mean, that is really, really fast. So to think of somebody reversing 60 feet in a straight line in the snow when she's drunk, 22 miles per hour, and she doesn't ever run into the grass, she doesn't hit the fire hydrant or the light pole where John's body was also near, it just seems really unfathomable. Just think about it and let me know what your thoughts are on that. Again, that has not come up though yet during the trial. We haven't heard from those forensic experts. So I am looking forward to see exactly how they reconstruct this incident. I think it'll be very interesting. But let's go ahead and get into the first 2 weeks of the trial. We've had some interesting testimonies and some aha moments. So let's get into that. First on the stand was John's brother, Paul O'Keefe, and his wife, Erin. When Erin was on the stand, she testified to a recent trip to Aruba that John and Karen went on, where they fought on the trip about John allegedly kissing the sister of someone else on the trip. And she also testified that after John died, Karen made a comment like, "I just have to remember the bad times," which struck her as odd. And it is an odd comment to make. However, I do think we have to remember that at the time she made that comment, she was heavily medicated and even suicidal. She was taken to the hospital on like a category 12, or it's similar to like a 5150 hold, like a psychiatric hold. And so she was treated for possibly being suicidal. And maybe she was saying that to make getting over his death a little easier. I mean, I don't know. I can't get into the mind of her in that moment. So next on the stand was Canton police officer Stephen Seraph, who was one of the first officers on the scene when John was found. And he testified that Karen was visibly upset when he arrived and kept repeating, "This is my fault. I did this." However, on cross, it was revealed that his official report that he made after the incident made absolutely no mention of those statements by Karen. In fact, in his report, he wrote, quote, "Karen kept screaming, 'Is he dead? Is he dead?' She was severely distraught and was not able to tell me what happened. I tried to console her and keep her out of the inclement weather. I had her sit in one of the cars. Sergeant Good arrived and started speaking to the other parties that were there," end quote. And he later said that not including these admissions of guilt was a simple oversight. And also, two other officers who were there on scene testified that after John's body was moved to the ambulance, they did not spot any pieces of taillight on the ground. Now, during that first week, multiple emergency responders who were there on the scene testified that they heard Karen say repeatedly, "I hit him, I hit him." But Karen's defense team pointed out that absolutely nobody who testified to that included it in their reports. So their memory 2 years later is better than within just minutes and days, hours of the incident. Then firefighter Katie McLaughlin took the stand and testified that Karen repeatedly said, "I hit him, I hit him," while paramedics were working on him. However, on cross, it was revealed that Katie's story has evolved and that she has close ties to the Albert family, which she originally tried to deny. She tried to downplay her relationship to the Alberts, and specifically Brian Albert's daughter, Caitlin, by saying, quote, "I went to school with someone by that name." But then the defense team pointed out that they were actually friends. They went to school together, but they also ran on the same track team and they partied together and they were photographed together, like arm in arm, drinking at a party together multiple times. So when defense attorney Alan Jackson asked her if her story has evolved, she said, "Okay, yes." Yikes. The next day, Lieutenant Paul Gallagher testified to the process of collecting evidence from the scene. You guys, Canton police officers Michael Lank and Sean Good collected blood samples found in the snow with red Solo cups that they borrowed from a neighbor's house, and then they stored them in a grocery bag. Then they used a leaf blower to blow the snow around in an attempt to find more blood droplets, but also testified that this process never revealed any pieces of broken taillight. At this point, those pieces were still not yet found. And just a reminder, they weren't found until after Karen's car was already seized. Interpret that how you will. Now, when Officer Lank took to the stand, he testified that he did not check for signs of a fight when he went inside the Albert's home. He's friends with Brian and Nicole Albert, and defense attorney Alan Jackson pointed out how that conflict of interest resulted in a shoddy investigation by him. On day 8 of the trial, Brian Albert's brother Chris took the stand and was questioned about his relationship with John O'Keefe, but even more notably, John's relationship with Chris's son, Colin. Now, Colin, if you'll remember, is the dim-witted hothead, in my opinion, and the defense is theorizing that Colin could have played a part in John's death because of the beef that he had with John over Colin's disrespect towards John, coming into his lawn and leaving a bunch of beer cans. I guess they lived next door to one another at one point. So the defense was able to poke holes in the credibility of Chris's story regarding what time he got home on the night of January 29th after the party at Brian's. Chris originally alleged that he got home around 12:20 and that his son Colin arrived home about 10 minutes after him. However, surveillance from Waterfall Bar and Grill showed that Chris didn't actually leave until about 12:15, making it impossible for him to be home at 12:20. Then Colin Albert took the stand on May 16th, and the majority of his answers were, "I don't know, I don't remember." You could tell it was clear he was coached on what to say when he was on the stand. And finally, defense finally said, "Do you remember anything about this case?" Like, you could tell they were just tired of it because they knew he wasn't being truthful. At one point, they asked if he had a propensity to fighting or was ever involved in fights, to which he vehemently denied that he's not a violent guy. He doesn't get into fights. But then a photo was brought up from February 26th of Colin out with friends at a bar. And in this photo, his hand is scuffed up and bruised as if he had gotten into a fight. It looks like he'd gotten into a fight. The defense points out that his right hand and knuckles are injured in this photo. And Colin said that he was at a house party that night and was walking up an icy hill and slipped, and that he braced himself against the ground with his fist because he was carrying something in his left hand. So he fell and slid down the driveway on his right fist. Okay, sure. Even the defense was like, seriously? They literally said that. If you could have watched it, I think I have the clip. I'm going to see if I can find it and play it for you now.
Party, my house party my senior year. And it was, I remember it being icy out, and it was kind of like a steep hill of a driveway. And I was walking up the driveway and I slipped down the driveway and I tried to catch myself, but I had something in my left hand. So I tried to brace myself with my right hand and I ended up sliding a little bit down the driveway.
What'd you have in your left hand?
If I remember, it was either my phone or a beverage.
So according to you, you fell on ice and injured your knuckles, as we just saw in that photograph, right across the top of your knuckles.
Correct.
So you fell onto what, pavement, asphalt?
Yes.
And you braced yourself when you fell, your entire body weight, by putting your right hand down in a fist, and you injured your right fist, just the top of the knuckles on your right fist, when you fell down.
Correct.
Seriously?
The pause before he says seriously, it says everything. But he was then asked if he ever gets into fights or if he boxes or just gets into fights. And he denied all of the above. So the defense tried to bring into play a video of Colin Albert talking into the camera and threatening the recipient of that video. And they were arguing back and forth between the defense and the prosecution over whether or not they should be allowed to show those videos to the jury. The defense argued that the videos should be allowed to be shown to the jury because it supported that there was a lack of a proper investigation. Nobody ever looked into who was at the party, one of whom being Colin Albert, who has a propensity to fight. And then it also supports the third-party culprit defense, which encourages the jury to consider the possibility of a third party, which is to say, if you can consider the fact that John could have died at the hands of anyone else other than Karen Reed, then she is not guilty. So it's not to say that Colin did this and at the end of this trial, Colin should be found guilty. It's just to say, if you believe Colin is capable of it, then you definitely can't find Karen guilty. Anyway, at the end, the judge allowed the videos into evidence, which was a big win for the defense. The prosecution tried to downplay it as if it was just trash talk between two hockey teams, But it contradicted Colin's previous testimony that he had never been in a fight, was never violent, had no violent tendencies, and was never aggressive. And in the videos, he's literally talking about how he's going to beat their ass, to pull up, that he's going to fuck them up. And it's just really interesting to hear the defense team quote the things that Colin was saying in this video, because Colin on the stand is basically downplaying everything, that he never fights. He's just this good kid. He's dressed in literally a polo, like a collared shirt with a sweater over it. He's, you know, head to toe in Vintage Vines or Vineyard Vines or whatever that preppy brand is, trying to, you know, look like this goody two shoe that just never gets into trouble. But all of the other footage and pictures and video we have of him prior to John O'Keefe's death shows him as this arrogant little shit, basically. So that is where I left off watching the trial. We've had a lot of stuff come up this weekend, and so I know there was a lot of things that happened Friday, because Jen McCabe took the stand yesterday, and there was a lot of stuff that came up. There was also some discrepancies with screenshots of text messages between Colin Albert and the girl that was supposed to pick him up from the party that night. And there is proof that the screenshots that the Albert family provided to the court was actually photoshopped and manufactured. And we're going to talk about that in the next episode. So hang in there with me. I know this is like going pretty deep, deeper than I usually go in a story. But considering the fact that this is ongoing and it's going to go on for a while, I feel like more people should be talking about this, because this is a blatant display of corruption in the law enforcement agency that is in Canton, Massachusetts. So everyone should be talking about it. This should be a much bigger story than I believe it is. So hang in there with me. We'll come back next week to talk about more updates in the case, and we'll get into all the screenshots and who is Turtle Boy and why the FBI is getting involved and all of that next week on Mama Mystery. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.